This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 442 for November 16th of 2018, The Ultimate in Ultima. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Oh, hey, everybody, welcome to Autoline After Hours. We got a great show coming up. And we got a very interesting panel here, including Mr. Auto Extremist, Peter DeLorenzo, back in the house.
Back from the dead, yes.
You doing okay?
I'm doing well, very well. The site is, I'm still bringing it every week.
And, yes, you are.
You know, people are waiting for me to stop, but I'm not ready to stop
yet. Yeah, good. And we have Mark Phelan with us, the autocritic from the Detroit Free Press.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
Yeah, good to have you here. And we got to let everybody know our special guest right now is Christian Spencer, the senior manager for marketability at Nissan.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad and we've here. Got an all new, I have to emphasize this. This is not a refresh. This is not a nose job. This is the all new Nissan Altima we've got in the studio.
That's right. All new platform. We've got two new engines. We're adding all wheel drive, and it's a great new styling direction that we're going with the vehicle as well.
Cool. Well, we're going to get into a lot more detail on the car in just a minute, but Carmen tells me we've got a phone call. Carmen, let's bring that one in right now.
Greetings, gentlemen. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio, and my message is for Peter. I was so excited hearing that you were back on After Hours, I had to put a seatbelt on my desk chair to keep from falling out of it. Peter, you know how much I miss seeing you, and this show is going into my archives. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that, Dale.
Well, yeah, thanks, Dale.
Yeah. Hopefully the archive isn't the circular basket next to his desk. Well, let's get back to the Altima here. And well, first off, Christian, what the hell does this mean? Manager of marketability.
So marketability is where you try to be the voice of the customer in the engineering realm. So left to their own devices, engineers might develop the most efficient vehicle in the planet, but we try to make sure that we're really representing the customer. So it's the marketability portion is representing the market. And a lot of what we do is the initial target setting early on, and we manage those targets throughout production and make sure that the final product actually matches the intention from the early phase.
Okay, Altima's been on the market a long time now. Here's your chance. Clean sheet. You can do just about whatever you want. What were some of the top things on your want list?
So we wanted to make it fresh styling was a big portion of it. Since we were doing two new engines, we had the opportunity to change the front end. We lowered it a little bit, so front visibility is better. But we also got a really sharp hood and low cowl to really emphasize the styling. So that was the first point, was lowering the platform so that we could lower the engines, which lowered the hood and get more sleek styling. We wanted a bigger car. It's 2 inches longer. We wanted it to be kind of lean and wide and sportier, so it's lower as well. It's an inch lower, and it's an inch wider. And we also wanted to add all-wheel drive. There's a big opportunity in the mid-sedan for all-wheel drive.
Why? So,
because there are a lot of people that do not want to be driving an SUV. Necessarily. They're more expensive, they're less efficient, they lose the driving dynamics, and they're very popular, which is actually a downside for some of the younger generation who want to differentiate themselves from their, you know, their uncool parents. So that's a real big driver for the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. I like the three key words in your little write-up here, longer, lower, wider. I thought it was 1966 again.
It comes around, goes around, yeah. I suppose. Yeah. But no, that was a real push from the styling department was to make it lower and leaner.
The sea pillar is interesting.
Yes, it's part of the floating roof design that started. It's in Murano. We have it in Maxima. Leaf has it as well, and some of the predecessors. So it's something that's carried through as part of the Nissan design language recently.
Well, this looks, it looks big just sitting here. Where does the Maxima compare to this? Is it Maxima all that much bigger? It must not be.
At this point, the Maxima is actually not bigger. The wheelbase is stretched on this, so this vehicle is a little bit bigger. The Maxima is a different type of customer in that it's not a vehicle that is needed in the household. It's the vehicle that the household wants. So it's really much more of an emotional purchase, and it's about differentiated styling and luxury and performance versus an Altima, which is much more of a kind of our brand ambassador vehicle.
Yeah, because this doesn't even look mid-size, to Peter's point. This looks like a full-size car.
Yeah.
And the mid-size segment keeps growing and growing. If you go back to our first generation in 93... the whole car probably would have fit between the wheelbase of this one. So it's definitely a trend that the segment's following, and to have that second row roominess is really important.
It's interesting that you said that, though. The midsize segment is growing in terms of the size of the vehicles, and they're squeezing out, in fact, the old full-size vehicles in many ways. But the midsize segment is under pressure from the SUVs that you were talking about earlier. There are a number of companies that have decided that they're just going to, bail out of it. Nissan, obviously not. This is one of your hallmark vehicles. What's the thinking behind why being in the midsize market makes sense when there are companies like Ford and Fiat Chrysler that have said, no, we're going to bail?
We're able to be a very competitive product in the midsize segment. There's 2 million vehicles available for sale in the midsize segment, and we're able to capture a nice share of that and consistently year over year. So while it's maybe not competitive for everyone to be in there, a la maybe like the old minivan, if you've stuck around in minivan, you can do well. But there's not a huge slice for everyone to play in. We're able to play in this segment really well, delivering a car that is, the top three sales. So it's really important for us to have a strong product because we see kind of convergence of the SUV and the sedan sales. So we want to be a player in that area.
And when some people talk about sedans, like they're an endangered species and the roads will, you'll no longer see them on the roads at all. There's going to be an Altima for the foreseeable future.
There's going to be an Altima for the foreseeable future. There are 6 million sedans sold. So while SUVs have taken some of the share, it's still a high sales area and still plenty of opportunity for manufacturers to have competition in there.
Another feature on this car is ProPilot, is what you guys call it, right?
ProPilot Assist is our autonomous drive technology. It's single lane technology, and what it does is it will enhance your driving experience. So you can turn it on, and it'll follow the lane. It'll also follow the car in front of you as well. So it's a hands-on, eyes-on system, but it takes a lot of stress out because the car will steer itself and follow traffic as well.
And it seems to me like Nissan's trying to deploy this almost across the line, right?
We've been very aggressive with how we've deployed it. It's on Rogue, it's on Leaf, it's on Altima now, and it's all the way down in our SV grade, which is basically mid-level trim. So half of the available trims are going to have this technology available.
And it comes trim level. You cannot buy it as a standalone option, or can
that,
you?
That's correct. It comes in the SV trim, so SV and SL and Platinum will all have it standard.
You've had it out in the field now for a while. What's the early feedback?
Customers are very happy with it, and one of the main feedbacks we've gotten is that it's easy to use and it's easy to get comfortable with it quickly, and that's really some of the something that you want to be delicate with in autonomous drive is not overconfidence or underconfidence, so that you don't over rely on the system or not trust the system. And so to get the feedback that it's, confidence inspiring has been very positive.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a hard time communicating that message to customers? Because you said that it's autonomous driving feature, but it's also hands-on. I mean, do customers even understand what that means? And how do they make use of it?
We have a lot of material that tries to explain that. We rely on the dealership to explain that. We try and showcase it in our advertising. But you are correct. There's a learning curve for it, and we have to be very careful that the customer expectation matches the performance of the vehicle so that they can learn to adapt and basically come on board to use it successfully.
I had a vehicle for a fairly long road trip that was equipped with it, and I found that once you got used to it, it was really a matter of almost just having a hand resting on the steering wheel and letting the car do most of the work, and I found it quite relaxing. Is that the goal for what customers should experience?
Absolutely. It's to take some of that kind of mental fatigue or mental load out of driving, especially in conditions where it's not, there's a lot of enthusiasts here, winding canyon roads. It's not for that. It's for the highway commute. It's for the stop-and-go traffic. It's for those situations where you're happy to let the car kind of take over a little bit. And it's really to reduce the stress and reduce the workload. It's a comfortable system to drive with.
Yeah, I would describe it this way. Cruise control, traditional cruise control, takes away a layer of driver engagement. I'm not saying that you're not engaged, but it just helps you relax a little bit. Adaptive cruise, another layer. ProPilot, yet another layer still.
Right. You still need to be paying attention. You still need to be watching your surroundings. But in those situations where you're not that enthusiastic about driving, letting the vehicle take over is really comfortable.
And you've got this variable compression engine, which started it with Infiniti,
correct?
Right?
In the QX50,
and
that's right.
And now it's moving into the Nissan brand. Tell us a little bit about that. It's kind of complicated to explain, but do your best.
Okay, I'll try and be as simple as possible. Basically, varying compression varies the efficiency of the engine. And at high compression, we can have high efficiency, which means better fuel economy. And at low compression, we're able to generate more power using the turbocharger to generate that power. So what it allows us to do is kind of combine the power of the V6 engine with the fuel efficiency of a four-cylinder engine. And it's all seamlessly integrated. It's not something that you'd notice when you drive the vehicle, but it is whirring in the background with the compression ratio changing and the stroke of the engine changing.
I've driven it. To me, it's invisible.
Absolutely.
Because there's a more reciprocating mass within the engine to be able to achieve this. And you're going from low to high compression, and the turbo's coming. It just drives like an engine. I mean, I couldn't find any point where I could trick the system. Sometimes you can jump on the gas, get out of it, get back into it, and you clunk, 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 clunk. And I didn't get any of that.
Yeah, if we didn't market it, you would never know that the technology exists from driving the vehicle. It's totally seamless and drives like any other turbocharged four-cylinder engine from the integration.
And is most of the benefit in driving around town, sort of city conditions, because you're using the turbocharger less at that point, or is there benefit in fuel economy in highway driving as well?
It's actually both. We see, compared with our outgoing V6, there's about a 3 mile per gallon improvement in both city and highway driving. Obviously, that will vary based on your driving style. But we do see it in both scenes.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the VC turbo, because I wanted to ask a sort of related question. You've got two engines. The other one is a normally aspirated 2.5-liter four-cylinder, I think.
That's correct.
And you've got the all-wheel drive system, but that's only available with the base 2.5-liter, which is the less powerful engine, and it seems like it would be a more natural fit to offer that with the VC turbo. What's the thinking? What do customers want the all-wheel drive for?
Sure. So we really wanted all-wheel drive to be accessible and be on our most popular vehicles. That's going to be the 2.5-liter engine. All-wheel drive is available at the lowest grade and that's kind of the lowest price point of the vehicle as well. So that customer that is maybe forced into an SUV because they want all-wheel drive can come over to Altima and have the dynamic performance. They can have the fuel efficiency, the lower entry ticket to be able to do that. So it's really about accessibility and less about if we put it on the VC turbo engine, it would be a much more expensive car. Probably
it's got to be a very expensive engine.
I can't answer that, but we do definitely charge for it. It's a it, It's more expensive for the vehicle. So you would be pushing into the higher price points of the vehicle, and it would actually be more of a niche product than it would be something that the consumer might really take to.
Oh, interesting. What do you think the take rate will be with all-wheel drive?
We haven't put out any numbers. It'll certainly be double-digit take rates across the country. But in northern climates, it could be as high as 50% on the dealership lots when you're talking about, Detroit area and New York and places like that. The Canadian market, for example, is only taking all-wheel drive vehicles. So they said there's no market for the front-wheel drives now that you're offering all-wheel drive in Canada.
So poor Canadians don't get the VC Turbo?
They do not get the VC Turbo. They will have to. They'll have to import one, take it across the bridge.
Come down here and drive it.
That's right.
That's hey, right. We've got a number of questions coming sure. in here. Jay Siegel wants to know, CVT?
CVT. It is a CVT. We've done a lot of tuning for the CVT. We've made the shifting crisper, and we've made a much more linear feel to it. But we're keeping with the CVT on the Altima.
And by the way, for anybody in the audience, if you want to get in on the questions, we're not going to guarantee we're going to answer them all. We'll try to. Shoot us an email. Send it to viewermail@autoline.tv. Or we'll take phone calls, as you heard at the top of the show. That number is 620-288-6546. Jay Siegel goes on to say he says he loves the Maxima CVT in sport mode.
Excellent. Yes, this is a later iteration of the same tuning. As I said, we've made some changes. Obviously, it's four-cylinder combination, so you have to tune it specifically for an engine. You can't just carry over. But it's there in spirit as far as the D-step shifting and the linear power delivery.
Yeah. Joe E. wants to know, why is there a big gap between the hood and the headlights on this new Altima? Sean, you did a video on that, right?
Yeah,
you guys can't hear Sean back in the back of the studio, but we've actually got a video posted online. Maybe you can pick up and explain that gap there.
Yeah, so basically that is styling driven, and really what the designers wanted to do was accentuate the character line going down the side of the car. And so when you look at it from the side view, there you can see it. It really carries through the entire length of the vehicle and through the body line. And part of that was the sort of clamshell design. So that was very, very important to them. So that's why it is a unique design. It's there for that styling.
It's not an air intake like some people have speculated.
No, it's not. It doesn't provide any mechanical advantage.
It's not a gap for over slam when you slam the hood down.
No.
So that it's a styling feature.
Yep, that is as there on purpose as a styling feature. So
are we going to see that front end in other Nissans?
I can't comment on too much of our
good question.
future design. It always the future product.
I love
question.
When they always say, "Wow, we can't answer that." That's
we
a good
can't
question.
Talk about future products.
Yeah. This,
but
this,
you guys the, like the look.
The V Motion grill is definitely a styling cue that you will see going forward.
It's got a name, V Motion.
Yes, and that's something that we've publicized before. So it's called the V Motion grill, and yeah, you will see that as part of the Nissan design language.
Okay, Kit Gerhardt wants to know, will there be an Altima hybrid to compete with the Camry hybrid?
Right now, we do not have any plans for a hybrid.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. We have, we're pretty comfortable with the fuel economy that we're getting on the vehicle. It's 39 mpg on the highway. So we did have an Altima hybrid for a little while. There wasn't a lot of demand from our product side. So we're sticking with the two engines we have right now as far as the powertrain goes.
Mm-hmm. QuintSpeed wants to know, how did the changes affect the 50-50 weight distribution? Did you have 50-50 before?
I don't think we had 50-50.
Not with a front drive car.
No, it's normally more of a 60-40 weight distribution. I don't think our weight distribution changed a whole lot. The all-wheel drive vehicle with the more mass in the back will probably have a closer ratio, but we're not a 50-50. On our weight distribution.
The Lotus Evora underneath.
Yeah. Right.
Depends how much you put in the trunk, I suppose.
Yeah. Bright Knight 70 says, with the Altima reaching as high as it does these days, it seemed to me the Maxima should go rear-wheel drive based in the future.
Well, we generally split our front drive and rear drive between Nissan and Infiniti. So the Infiniti platform is the rear-wheel drive platforms for our sports sedans and our or Z-Car. So the Nissan side is generally front drive platform layout.
Joey's cleaning lady, I love that handle, wants to know, can you still get a manual transmission in the Altima?
You cannot. To the dismay of all engineers across the world, you cannot get a manual transmission. Unfortunately, there's just less and less demand for manual transmissions in the auto industry these days. So, and especially in a mainstream sedan. When we offered it in Altima, we weren't able to sell a lot. There just wasn't the demand for it.
And where do you guys make this car?
We have two locations. It's made in Smyrna, Tennessee, and also in Canton, Mississippi. So we're running two different plants to manufacture it.
That's a lot of cars when you have it in two plants.
It's a lot of cars. It gives us the flexibility to manage between two plants based on demand. The Smyrna plant came online first in September, and then Canton came online about a month after that.
Is this a U.S. market car only?
For the most part, the vast majority.
And Canada, too, right?
Canada, Latin American countries, we do export it. We have a general overseas market. It'll go to Israel and Korea and Gulf Coast countries. But for the most part, it is a North American product. It's only sold in, it's a left-hand drive car only.
Mm-hmm. And does that mean that the development and design primarily took place here as well?
The vast majority of it did, yes. China has a version of it that is basically Japan responsible right now. But we took responsibility fairly early on, and so most of the development was done in this country.
And the Chinese one is built in China?
Yes, I believe so.
What else are we missing here?
We didn't talk about all-wheel drive that much, which is, we talked about it a little bit, yeah. But I think it's going to be a real unique opportunity for the midsize segment. There was basically only two players before. Fusion had all-wheel drive. It was higher in the grade walk, and Subaru offers it as well. So we think offering all-wheel drive being a second option is a really great opportunity for the customer in this segment.
What do you charge for it?
The price is about, you're testing me, I think it's about $1,350.
That's not a bad price at all, really. I thought you were going to say $18,000 to $2,000 or something like
no,
that.
No, especially if you look at what it costs to get into an SUV and then you factor in the fuel costs as well. It's really a good deal to get that, especially when you can get it at the base grade car.
We got a couple of questions here from the audience, but I think we've addressed it. You're not using the VC turbo engine from a price point standpoint for the all-wheel drive. You're saying with that engine it might get a little too pricey for what you want to achieve in sales?
Most likely is we think it would be a niche product because it would get expensive. The variable compression turbo is available on our SR grade, which is our sporty version, and also on the platinum grade, which is the top version. So you would be tacking all-wheel drive onto a platinum vehicle, which then pushes into Maxima territory, And the value proposition could get a little.
That's a great point. You got to make sure this car doesn't cannibalize Maxima.
It definitely has to be a consideration. We have more differentiation now because this is a four-cylinder vehicle only. Maxima is V6. Maxima customers less concerned about fuel economy and more about performance. So there's some differentiation that allows us to make sure that we're not going to cannibalize too much.
Good deal.
Do you think you have too many models? SR, SV, SL, and Platinum? There's 13 different versions.
We've gone away from options and we've gone to grades. And actually the customer responds better to that because it's easier to understand. You're just moving up in a grade walk as opposed to across to add one package. And so much of the purchases are based, you know, on the dealership lot that it's a lot easier to understand the window sticker and what you're buying to go from S to SR to SV.
So, yeah, you go from $23,750 to $35,750.
That's right. And it's associated with a grade that is on the back of the car as opposed to an option package that would be maybe buried in a Monroney or something like that. So it makes it easier for the customer.
Is rear automatic braking, is that used in the industry, or is that just you?
There are other manufacturers that have it. I don't know who has it, but we're offering it, you know, in the middle of the grade to make it really accessible as part of our our packaging.
And what's that?
It'll keep you from backing into the shopping cart in the
or
crushing your bicycle in your garage. So it's using the sonar system to basically stop the vehicle if you are going to hit something.
That is, I'm sure the insurance companies kissed you when you announced you were doing
it. I mean, I noticed that. I haven't heard of that. I mean, that's a big deal.
Especially in this segment.
Right.
I mean, there's a couple of luxury vehicles that have got it. I'm not sure there's anything that's this much of a mass vehicle.
Right. And that's part of our Safety Shield 360 package, which is the rear braking. It's the blind spot warning, the lane departure warning and prevention, the automatic emergency braking, the ProPilot assist, and I'm probably forgetting one or two, but the idea is that it encompasses the whole car, and the car is really keeping track and making sure that you're not going to do anything that you're not intending on doing. But you do get an insurance discount when you have those technologies. It's something that I've noticed the insurance folks are asking these days if that's standard or if it's on your vehicle.
Is that what would you call the safety package again?
The Safety Shield 360.
Is that a standalone option?
That is standard in our SV grade.
Okay.
So that is where the ProPilot Assist comes in.
Let's go to the chart, John.
Yeah. I was going to say.
So the one item that's standard is the automatic emergency braking. That's standard on every Altima, which is which lets you know if you're going to run into something. And then prevents you from it puts
it'll
up the brakes.
Hit the brakes
it'll
if
hit
you
the
don't.
It'll hit the brakes if you don't. You'll get a big warning, and that's one that the insurance industry is very, very positive.
I'd say the two, the automatic braking, looking forward, and the backup one. I think that's awesome.
It's great. All the trash cans are thanking us quite a bit in the garage. The
bicycles.
Yeah, that's right. The one thing is the forward emergency braking. The front is much higher speed. So,
sure, yeah.
So from an insurance standpoint, from a vehicle damage standpoint, you're going to really the benefit. There's a huge benefit there. The other one is more for the slower
going in
speed.
The garage and stuff like that. I've done a lot of things in cars. I haven't yet gone in reverse at 70 miles an hour.
Right. So it's a little different of a driving scene, but it's the same idea. It's going to keep your car from maybe touching something you don't want it to.
Good deal. Well, look, we ought to wrap this up right now, but Christian, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's as I always say, it's so good to have the car in the studio. It's just the best way. It helps trigger a lot of thoughts.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Are you known as Dr. No internally when the engineers want something and you say no?
No, not at all.
I'm just kidding.
Real good. We're going to take a quick break right now and give a shout out to our friends at BorgWarner.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Okay, we're back talking all things automotive here. And
Mark, you just drove the Quadrifoglio Stelvio.
I did indeed.
I have a regular one for my personal driver.
Very good.
What'd you think?
I love it. SUVs are getting to the point where they're beginning to be a bit of a glut, and there's a sameness to a lot of them. There is no sameness to the Quadrifoglio or the base Stelvio. But no, that 505 horsepower, that Ferrari engineered V6, it's just a great car. I love that vehicle.
Sales are going good, too. I mean, sales are still small for Alfa Romeo. The other thing that I found interesting is the Giulia's doing pretty well. As the market continues to switch over to crossovers and SUVs, Giulia's doing pretty good.
And it's a nice car, too. I mean, awareness was so low when they launched it, and it deserved to do better than it did initially, so that's good news.
Well, the reason I got a Stelvio is I had to see for myself if the Alfa brand had a chance here. And I wasn't going to do that with a media car or anything. I just decided, okay, I'm going to see. I'm going to own one. I'm going to get service. I'm going to do the whole thing. And so far, I'm impressed with it.
When you consider that it's their first SUV, they did such a good job of transferring the Alfa character into it.
Well, it really feels like a Juliet with a little more ground clearance, which is impressive as hell.
Yeah. So the big question is, has it been reliable? Because that's what everybody's worry has been. Beautiful car, drives great, but...
It's been reliable. There's been two recalls, both for reflashing the computer, which took 30 minutes visit to the dealer at Gowling. And I was really impressed with that dealer, by the way. And so that wasn't really a problem for me, but there hasn't been anything wrong with it. The only thing I don't like on the standard Stelvio is the shifter feels very cheap to me. And that's the first thing I would address. Hopefully they will in the next
year. Is it the shift quality or the physical feel of the
physical
shifter?
The physical feel of the shifter.
Yeah.
It just feels...
chintzy.
It's the only thing about the car that I keep bringing up when I write about it. But other than that, I like it a lot.
Yeah. No, I love driving the vehicle. Yeah. I haven't driven it since last year, but Mark, you were just in it?
You know, I just got into it again because I was thinking it was too long since I had been, and it was delightful, I have to say. I mean, in addition to, I know what you mean with the shifter, although that didn't strike me as much.
Well, the Quadrifoglio is a whole different animal, though, really.
It is.
But
it's a beast.
The rotary controller for... navigation and infotainment.
Yeah.
That's a mess, like all rotary controllers are.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too. I was talking to somebody at Fiat Chrysler, and they said that it was put in because Harold Vester, who was then the head of Alfa Romeo, he grew up in the VW Audi system with the German luxury idea that rotary controllers are the way to go. Yeah. And that's why they've got one rather than Chrysler's infotainment system, which is a breeze.
Yeah,
I like rotary controllers. And what I like about it is that I can put my hand on it, keeping my eyes on the road. I don't have to search and see is my finger on the icon on the screen. And because when you twist the rotary dial, there's detents. So I know that I can reach over, I can go two detents over, push down, and now I'm in XM radio or something like that. I just find it a
whole
lot.
If you've learned this, XM radio is two detents down, so you don't have to look at the screen. You're doing better than I am,
yeah.
I have to say. That's where it falls apart for me. I still find myself looking at the screen as much or more.
I haven't driven a Quadrifoglio. I mean, it's $30,000 more than my car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a substantial step up. And the only reason I've driven it is, they loan us to me and Mark to test drive these things. So. Hey, speaking of Alfa Romeo, there's this investor group that came out last week that said, and I'm use my words, time to drop the F in FCA, time to get Fiat and just spin it off.
Call it Jeep, cheap
Ram.
Jeep Ram, yeah. I saw that.
And I don't know if that I would go that far, but their point was, in the third quarter, 97% of the profits came from the old Chrysler group. It's mostly Jeep and Ram.
But do customers care? Mark LaNave, longtime sales exec with GM and Ford, he's got a great phrase for stuff. He says, that's north of Toledo thinking. And I feel like, people in Detroit, we obsess and we're aware of Fiat Chrysler has these five brands. Do the customers know, or do they just
they
relate to Jeep or Ram?
Right.
I think that was more the reality of how Fiat, the brand, is doing here, don't you think?
Well, yeah, Fiat, the brand here, is...
Yeah.
I don't see how it can survive. No. I feel for the dealers who invested in all that. I'm not trying to diss them or anything like that. And the effort that they've brought... sales just keep plummeting.
Well, and there's no investment program for the brand that we know of anyway. I mean, there's a very aggressive investment program for Jeep, for Ram, for Alfa Romeo. The others, they look like they're just going to wither. So, the Fiat really does feel very irrelevant in an American and increasingly, I think, a European context.
Look, the only place Fiat sells cars of any volume is in Europe and Latin America. And they don't break out the earnings for Fiat. They only break it out geographically. I'd be willing to bet Fiat doesn't make any money at all. Yeah. None whatsoever. And so the question then becomes, why should you invest billions Because that's what it takes, as you guys know. You want to do a new car program, you're talking about $1 billion. Why invest billions in a brand where you're never going to get a return on that money?
Yeah. Well, and I don't think they are. I mean, if you think about the last investment, the last Chrysler, Fiat Chrysler strategic announcements, they went into reasonable detail about the three that we're speaking warmly of. And, you know, Fiat, you know, Dodge and Chrysler were not mentioned at all.
Although this investor group was saying, spin off Maserati and Alfa Romeo. Just go back to the old Chrysler group. What do you guys think about that?
I don't know about that. I mean, although in the U.S., it's Jeep and Ram, basically. Mm-hmm. Alfa will always be a
Jeep, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Alfa will always be a niche product.
If they can get Alfa right, I don't see. If they spun those two off, they couldn't. I have a hard time understanding how they could survive without the infrastructure of engines, transmissions, everything else that are developed, you know, by the Chrysler Group. I mean, that wonderful 2-liter engine that's based in the Giulia and Stelvio was developed in Auburn Hills.
Yeah,
it's a great engine. So I don't see how it could survive as a standalone, and I don't know that the cost. It seems like it's a worthwhile gamble to try to make both of them flourish.
It's going to cost a lot of money. You're right. It's a good gamble because if it pays off, they should be very profitable brands. But it's going to take a lot of money to find out whether that works.
Yeah.
Kit Gerhardt just wrote in, is that 97% that I just said for the U.S. or is it for worldwide? No, that's for the entire corporation worldwide. 97% of the profits come from the Chrysler Group.
Yeah. Jeep and Ram.
Although, you know, I'll bet they make good money on the Charger, Challenger, and 300.
God, yes.
I bet they make
everything. I mean, those were amortized 12 years ago.
Yeah, 12 years ago.
There are new ones coming.
And seriously?
Yeah.
You're confident of that?
I am confident.
Oh, that's good news.
In fact, they should be out the end of next year. So about a year from now, they should be out.
Are they based on a stretched Giulia platform?
That was the goal at first.
Yeah.
And what I was told, and this is secondhand from an outside engineering company that was working on the program.
Well, that's the best kind.
Yeah, those are the best sources because they'll tell you everything. They said the platform wasn't big enough. They tried to stretch it, and it was just these are big cars. And they said that's not going to work. And
so did they develop a new?
No, they are going to do a significant refresh of the existing platform. And in fact, what they had said was you'll be amazed at what you see come out.
Well, there's a lot of technology that's unfolded in the last 12 years, so that's interesting.
Well, and it's amazing how relevant they've been able to keep those cars with a 12, 13-year-old platform.
Right. Well, you know, look, doing things like the Hellcat and the Demon, and what's the Elephant?
Elephant
engine. Thank you, Sean.
That's a crate motor, right?
Yeah, it's a crate motor. But it breathes, you know, relevance into those cars, that brand. And, you know, I still love the story that Tim Kaniska said that when he took the business plan for the Hellcat to the upper management, he said he built his business plan around building 2,500 cars a year. He said, John, the first year we did 25,000. So it's amazing what FCA has been able to do from a brand management standpoint with those cars.
I love the Elephant because they called the Hemi back in the day the Elephant motor.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
And I think we're living in a very good time where you can buy a crate with 1,000 horsepower in it.
What a country.
Yeah. Right. And you guys brought up the Ferrari engine, too, and the Ferrari designed or developed engine
the
for Alfa Romeo. Peter, what do you make of Ferrari and Formula One? You know, they started out this year with a bang. You know, I would say going halfway into the year, Vettel had won one more race than Lewis Hamilton. They were leading the Constructors and the Drivers' Championship, and then all of a sudden, they fell all over themselves.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's such a fine line between the front row and maybe three places back, and the technological gains from Mercedes have just been relentless. And Ferrari kind of goes in spurts. They'll be on it and thriving, and Vettel and Kimi will be, you know, right there. And then all of a sudden, it's just like something happens. And there's no explanation for it other than just they sort of shoot themselves in the foot all the time. And it's just weird. It's very weird. Because Vettel hasn't forgotten how to drive, although he's been making mistakes.
And here's one thing I find.
He's a stunningly good driver. I'm not a fan of his, but you have to recognize that kind of talent.
Yeah, he is just focused consistency is what I like to say.
What I wondered is, could we tie it to when Sergio Marchionne died? And the reason I say that is all the way up to the week before we knew anything was going on, Ferrari was kicking ass and taking names in Formula One. They had won more races than Mercedes. They were leading the championship. Then we get word that, oh, Sergio's in the hospital. That weekend was the German Grand Prix. Vettel, unbelievably, drives off the track in the rain and crashes and is out of the race. And then it's been downhill ever since then.
Well, it could be.
And I don't know. I'm not saying that Sergio drove the whole team to excellence, but could they be even subconsciously somewhat distracted? Because I can't ever remember in Formula One, Vettel just driving off the track.
Well, and he's spun at times when it's just been inexplicable, really. I frankly doubt that. I think that the top level of racers and engineers are so monomaniacal that it's hard to imagine anything like even Sergio's death having that kind of effect on him. What I really wonder about is how will they respond in the off season? I mean, because I don't think that he would have looked kindly upon what's happened in the second half of the season, because you're right, they fell apart after his death, after the summer break, really, and starting right before the summer break in Germany was when the wheels fell off. They made strategic decision mistakes. You know, Vettel did stuff that un-Vettel-like. So how do they recover? Do the same people make decisions next year?
Well, Formula One is such a weird world. Now, I think it was before Mexico. Did you see where Lewis said, well, Red Bull's going to have us covered in Mexico now. Now, how would they know that? I mean, it's such a weird world that they said, "Now we think they got this set up for Mexico." And sure enough, I mean, the Red Bulls were quicker. And it was just like, this is such a rarefied atmosphere that it's hard to understand.
It's crazy.
Well, you know, they collect all kinds of data on their competition, what they can get their hands on. They've got computer simulations, and they feed all this stuff in, and it goes, nah, Max is going to win. He's amazing, too, by the way.
Yeah.
He is phenomenal. But here's another thing, going back to Ferrari for the moment. You know, I like going through annual reports and all that, financial numbers. And in the third quarter, Ferrari had this nice little line that said, oh, by the way, we cut our Formula One research and development budget in the third quarter by 4 million euros. And I'm like, what? What? You're in the middle of the season. Things are starting to go downhill and you decide to cut your R&D budget. What? And some people said, well, maybe that's because they recognize they aren't going to do anything this season. And I'm like, well, yeah, you put that money to next season. You don't cut that out of your budget.
And they were close enough.
And so the question comes, is Ferrari hurting from being a publicly traded company now? Whereas you guys know, once you're publicly traded, wow, you got a whole bunch of other bosses to answer to.
But isn't it still mostly the Agnelli family investment fund? I mean, you know, they have... There are other shareholders, but they don't have control, I don't think, the other shareholders. I think the Agnellis are still in charge.
And I'm a little bit hazy on that. I think once you're a publicly traded company, it's not possible for somebody to own 51% of you. I think I'm right in saying
it doesn't seem to affect Mercedes.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. They're a public trade, but, you know, the Germans are, you know, we are going to win. So,
and Jay Siegel writes in to say, by the way, Marchionne was dead for weeks before they disclosed it. I don't mean to laugh about his death, but that's a funny thing to say. Okay, look, let's take another quick break. We got more things to talk about, but first, going to give a shout out to our friends at Lear and Bridgestone.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
But okay, that's a sad state of affairs.
I would have been grounded till I was 30.
Yeah. Right. Okay, Quiet Storm X wrote in to say, apropos of what we were talking about, Ferrari and their season going south and why. He says, hey, Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes had a lot to do with this.
Absolutely.
And that is so true.
They are relentless, focused. He's unbelievable. I don't know why people say he's not likable, because I think he's kind of a character. He does his own thing. When he gets away from the track, he goes off and... To Mercedes' credit, they don't try to say, Lewis, you shouldn't be at a fashion show in Tokyo. I mean, he just does what he wants to do.
All right. Chuck Grenchy says, apropos of Ferrari, the cars were good enough, the drivers good enough, the team failed in execution and strategy. I think that's true, although I would say Vettel has made some very uncharacteristic mistakes. But not a lot, one or two, but
totally
that's all
misread the race. He's right about strategy.
Strategy, yeah.
Dale Leonard wrote in from Cleveland to say he's a staunch save the manuals guy, and shame on Nissan for going away from manuals.
I agree, but you know that's where the business is going. You have to spend an awful lot of money to get a manual these days if you want, or just get a Corvette or something.
That's right. Look, I love manuals. All my cars have been and will be manuals. But in the car business, it's all about making money. Yeah. And man, is it hard to make money, certainly in the U.S. market, trying to sell a manual. It's so hard to
do. And especially in that segment, too. I mean, there's not much demand, period. In midsize sedans, it's really microscopic.
Yeah.
Okay, Dale, Barry Rector from Indy wrote in to say, do you think the extension of tax credits for electric vehicles is a good idea?
I would say yes. I think we should encourage them. I frankly would stand, if I wasn't wired in with a microphone, I would stand up and applaud the fact that GM last week came out and said they would like to see the EV mandate expanded from California to the whole country. I think that we need to encourage that. I think it's a good idea.
You know, what was also interesting, GM came out and said that, hey, we want one national standard. That got all the headlines. And then they also came out a few days later, and while they don't want Trump's freeze the standard at 2020, they also said, the Obama rules to get us to 2025. I'm filling in the blanks, right? They essentially said, we can't do this. Nobody can do this. This is a rate of improvement that the industry has never achieved in its history and cannot achieve. So while they got all these great accolades in the media, then a few days later, they let slip.
I think that's the position of just about every company, though. I mean, they all say the standards are correct. They want more time on it, and they want some kind of accommodation of the fact that when the standards were being set, nobody foresaw 50% of the market being SUVs. So I think that that's indicative of probably the thinking at most of the big companies, I would say.
And the tax credits, I don't know what they cost. I mean, I know it's $7,500 for a full BEV. I think a plug-in, you can get, $4,500 or something like that. How long do you do this? I mean, I understand, you got to sort of grease the skids to get this segment going, but...
I guess we're going to find out pretty soon what the investment Volkswagen's making in electrics and Audi Group, Audi Volkswagen. Wow, they're really aggressive.
Yeah, but,
I believe anybody in the numbers that they cite for that kind of stuff, though. I mean, Ford says they're spending $11 billion on electrification, but we don't know exactly what they mean by that. I want to see the results on the road.
I'm not sure the market demand is out there for all these electric cars.
I don't think it is. And you know, I've said that on the site, it's going to be the biggest marketing challenge in automotive history, is getting people to, you know, even seriously consider a fully electric car.
Mm-hmm. I think that we do have to recognize the fact that there's a strong body of evidence that we're doing irreparable damage to our home, though. And I mean, if we have to, you know, spend more money to stop that.
I see the future. Yeah, I see the future where if a two-car household, one will be a fully electric for urban use and then have an ICE vehicle for.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mark. You know, you got to do stuff to improve the environment. But if all these car companies go bankrupt trying to achieve that, you know, then how do you achieve it?
Yeah.
And, well, maybe you do. You know, we stop driving cars because nobody can make them anymore.
Now we'll be all on scooters.
Which are quite popular.
In that case, Ford and GM got it covered now, apparently.
If I read one more release about e-bike and scooters, and it's just like, time out, guys. I mean, what are you doing here?
You live in Birmingham. If your office was in downtown Detroit, you might feel differently. I mean, those things get a lot of use. They really do. And I know a number of people at the paper who commute on them.
Are they going to get used on a day like this?
Well, today, just so the audience knows, it is snowing outside. Yeah, I'm not sure that you want to go.
I'm going to have to ask my editor, because he actually, you know, takes them, you know, most days to and from the office. He's about a mile and a half from the office downtown. And I will ask him that. It's a good question.
Yeah, maybe they need to put studded snow tires.
Well, I think basically the scooter thing is going to take a slumber in the winter, because it's just going to be, I don't think people realize how cold it is, even at 15 miles an hour.
Yeah, the wind chill.
The wind chill, I mean.
And battery life is going to be reduced.
Yeah. So.
Well, I'm curious about all the scooters, too, from a liability standpoint, because we're starting, you know, nobody wears a helmet. They're zipping around, and it may be liability.
Well, that's my thing. I mean, you know, I've heard of, you know, the broken elbows and, you know, it's just a simple fall. I mean, if you're not lucky, you can get hurt, but whatever. It's the latest thing, I guess.
Yeah. So here's the other thing that I'm hearing people in the industry talk about, import tariffs. You know, that's sort of gone under the radar because we just had the elections and all this other stuff, and we're talking EV credits. But I can tell you, car dealers, retailers, have their hair on fire about this. And big concern. What do you guys think is going to happen? Is this a negotiating tactic by Trump with the Europeans? I mean, he's already slapped the tariffs on the Chinese. No more Chinese imports. That's going to come to a screeching halt if it hasn't already. But the Europeans are, and the Koreans, not so much the Koreans, we've got a free trade deal with them, the Europeans. Very, very. Where do you guys think this is going to go? Is it a negotiating tactic? Or are we going to wake up in January and all of a sudden we got 25% import tariffs on cars?
I don't know.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of movement and negotiations going on.
Yeah. Okay, Joey's cleaning lady is saying, hey, you guys aren't talking about the Jeep Gladiator. You know, all the leaked info, photos and info.
The intentionally leaked photos.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I just saw one the other day on Woodward with, you know,
camo still?
Camo's on it, but I mean, it was really clear what it was. I mean,
yeah.
And when I saw the picture.
No disguising that.
Yeah, no, when they showed the, you know, calculated leak photos of it, it's exactly what I saw.
What do you guys think of the name, Gladiator?
I like it.
It's fine.
I have to say, I was talking to someone in Chrysler, and they had to tell me that there was a Jeep pickup called the Gladiator in the mid-60s, maybe. The name rang no bells for me.
I don't remember.
That way. They insisted that it is. But I think it's a good name, and I think that, you know, the vehicle, it as long as they don't have really high sales expectations, they should make a lot of money on that sucker.
And you know, remember, too, back in the 80s, there was a Jeep pickup.
Yes.
Wasn't that
Scrambler.
The Scrambler?
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And
that was the rumor that it was going to be called a Scrambler.
Mm-hmm. Right. We all thought so. And there was the Comanche as well.
Yeah.
One of those two was based on the original Cherokee, but I can't remember which one.
Yeah, I can't.
Yeah. I think maybe the Comanche, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Hey, Sean, what was the other truck that we had
The Bronco.
The Bronco. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Do we have... You guys probably saw, and I don't know, these were photos that came out of the dealer meeting several weeks ago, and somebody got pictures of the new Bronco. I thought it looked pretty good.
I think it's going to be a great product. It's just 3 years late.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, like the Ranger.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, that's the one thing I've been hypercritical with Ford is their product cadence is always late.
And all of their decisions.
Well, there it is in there. Yeah, it's always late. Yeah. I don't understand. Yeah.
Well, and my question about the Bronco is they say that they're going after the off-road SUV market, and I don't know that there's any evidence that if you're not either Land Rover or Jeep that you can make a living selling in that market.
Well, it's one of the great names.
Bronco.
You think so?
In automotive, yeah. I really do. So... it will be up to them to really take advantage of that. It's a high recognition, huge recognition of that name. And that goes, it's
in
not
just... In the context of being an SUV.
Well, no, just being the name is evocative for most people.
Okay, and, so it's a good word.
Yeah, it goes beyond the OJ thing and everything else.
That's just silly.
Bronco is a great name, so... It's going to be one of those vehicles that you don't need, but you want. That's what they're going to go after.
The chat room's all alive on this. SubGR77 says, new Bronco looks like a reskinned Flex. Terrible.
I was thinking that, too.
Right Knight says, really? No kidding. Yeah. Right Knight says,
and
new
I like
Bronco.
Flex.
Yeah. Right Knight says, not what I was expecting. A little weird.
Well, we don't know if that's exactly it, but...
I think that's it. I've seen...
From the dealer show?
This might be the latest iteration, but I had seen something going back.
There was another one that was so good. So good. And this...
There was definitely one that was much less flexy.
There was definitely one that was very early, this late 60s Bronco that was, that I think that would have been.
And that vehicle, as you probably know, there are people scouring junkyards in California for pieces to put them back together and sell them for $100,000.
Yeah, they're extremely popular.
$100,000?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
There are six-digit Bronco resto mods out there.
Yeah.
Look, I remember as a kid, you know, Baja 500, Baja 1000, Bill Strope Racing.
Carnelli Jones, the big Ollie Broncos, sponsored by Olympia Beer. It's one of the most iconic vehicles, race vehicles ever. It was just fabulous.
Yeah. Oh, here we've got it. And that looks so ungainly by today's standards.
Yep. Yeah.
But in the day, that was really cool.
Well, that's got that's a standard, you know, three on the tree Bronco, I'm sure.
Inline
12 narrow tires.
Hey, we're getting to the top of the hour here, and besides all the questions coming in from the audience, we got a phone call, and I always like to make sure we get to them. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
This is Clem Zarofsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. Do any of you guys think that NASCAR might be getting a little nervous now after they gave Ford the big aero break that Toyota might end up winning the championship again? You know, Ford hasn't won in 15 years, and I'm sure the people at Ford are starting to get a little wondering why they're spending all this money in NASCAR. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. Peter, you got a lot of... Did Ford get an aero break over the others, over Chevy and Toyota? They've been awfully strong this year.
Yeah.
Incredibly.
Well, their engines are good, too. But, there's been a little bit of an aero break. But, I mean, the bigger overriding concern is the future of NASCAR, period.
Right.
The Franz family is serious about looking around to sell it. The attendance is going down. The TV viewing numbers are going down. The big teams can't get sponsors. I mean, it's getting ugly.
I know, but their viewership is still four times what Indy is and five or six times what one is in the U.S.
Yeah. But they got serious trouble. And their next TV contract's probably going to be 30 cents on the dollar. Hmm. And that's going to be a real big adjustment for everybody.
And I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember. They're down to the final four. Is it two Fords and two Toyotas?
It is.
Okay,
right.
Thank you. Yeah.
Harvick, Logano, and Fords, Kyle Busch, and Martin Truex, and Toyotas.
Right.
So the thing that I was wondering, you know, when I saw that, as I thought I recalled, was how many heads are going to roll at GM over this? Because, I mean, Chevy has been taken for granted as, if not the champion, a strong contender for a generation.
Yeah, Chevy won year after year after year, and they have not
been. They were always in the mix.
Yeah, and they have not been in the mix this year. Well, a few times they have been. So, you know, they'll lobby NASCAR, and there'll be all kinds of shenanigans, and who knows what's going to happen.
Real good. Well, with that, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. But right. Mark Phelan, great having you here.
You.
This has been really good. Peter, awesome having you back on the show.
Glad to be here, Jim.
I love getting your insights on this stuff. And, of course, as I always say, I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.